All right, our next case is Jang versus SoFi Securities, LLC. And Mr. Saferstein, whenever you're ready, you may begin.
Good morning, may it please the court. I am Peter Saferstein on behalf of appellants. With me at council table is Gary Graveman. Just a point of order before I start, I mentioned this to the clerk's office earlier. This case is against Apex Clearing Corporation. SoFi is not a party to this case. They are not a defendant. They're not a plaintiff. They have nothing. They are not in this case.
Yes, thank you for noting that.
Okay. In dismissing plaintiff's complaint, the MDL court made fundamental errors of law. During the limited time that I have today, I want to address three errors in particular. One, the MDL court committed reversible error in finding that defendant Apex, and Apex is a clearing corporation and also a broker-dealer, and Apex, as a clearing corporation, cleared for more than 100 introducing brokers. We are talking about a behemoth that controls an enormous part of the market. The court found that Apex did not owe any duties to plaintiffs. Apex did. Apex did, even as a clearing broker and clearly as a broker-dealer. They owed both the duty of ordinary care, and they also owed fiduciary duties. A key question is how a reasonably prudent broker would act under similar circumstances of January 28th, 2021.
So,
we know the answer.
Mr. Saferstein, I will tell you, I find this case very difficult. And the reason I find it difficult is there does not seem to be a tremendous amount of law that clears things up for us either way. There's the Conway case, right? And under Conway, the court found that there was a specific duty by a clearing broker to use reasonable efforts to give its principal information relevant to the affairs that have been entrusted to it. So that's like a duty of providing information. But later cases seem to have tried to cabin that right, or that duty rather, to just the information context. And so I wonder if you could tell us what your best cases are for your position.
Well, there are two cases that are the best cases. And the first case is the Conway case, because the Conway case stands for the proposition that broker-dealers owe, actually there are three excellent cases. Conway is the first one. Conway stands for the proposition that broker-dealers owe their customers both duties under negligence and also under fiduciary duty. And that's clear. And that is a Second Circuit case. Another Second Circuit case that's very important.
But the problem is the specific duty that they talk about in that context is a duty to provide information.
I disagree, Your Honor.
Right. What do you think?
Because the duty there in Conway had to do with the unauthorized liquidation of an account. It did not have to do with information. Information is limited. The other part, which I think is very important over here, is that.
Was that a case where the customer had delegated discretionary duty to the broker-dealer?
They had discretionary duty. Actually, that's a little bit of a strange case, because they had delegated duty to the clearing broker, but not to the broker, and the broker was Icon, and Icon acted inappropriately, not pursuant to any agreement. And because there wasn't an agreement, and because there was a liquidation of the account, had nothing to do with information. The case went to trial. The jury found liability against the broker-dealer, both for negligence and for breach of fiduciary duty, and the Second Circuit affirmed. But more to the point, and I think very critically, is the DeKwiatkowski case from the Second Circuit makes it very clear that there is, quote, no doubt a duty of reasonable care applies to the broker's performance of its obligations to customers with non-discretionary accounts. And the third case that I think is very, very important is perhaps the case that's most on point that, quite honestly, the MDL judge in this case totally ignored, and that is the McDaniel case. And the McDaniel case, which is a New York case, affirmed an arbitration decision noting that a clearing broker had liability both for fraud and for breach of contract. And not only did they have liability for fraud and for breach of contract, they had liability specifically because the clearing broker was involved in restricting trades. That is precisely the issue that was before the court. The MDL court said they didn't see any cases. We briefed that case. In reality, the MDL court, when the MDL court issued its opinion, the MDL court did not find, did not even cite to the case, and it was the case that is, in fact, the most relevant case. And the McDaniel case—
That the McDaniel case involved participation in the fraud on the part of the clearing broker?
Well, in the McDaniel case actually stands for what the McDaniel case says, and the language in the McDaniel case is very important, because here it says where a clearing firm, so we're talking about clearing firm liability, moves beyond performing mere ministerial or routine clearing functions. And mind you, the MDL court made a specific determination over here that, in fact, we did move beyond ministerial functions, that clearly the there was involvement, because it wasn't the introducing brokers that had ordered this one-way halt. It was, in fact, the clearing broker which had done that. And then the language is, it becomes actively and directly involved in the introductory broker's actions. It may expose itself to liability with respect to the introductory broker's misdeeds. So there you have an instance where clearly you're not just talking about ministerial actions, but you're talking about actions which create liability for the clearing broker.
My question is, what in McDaniel, I've been looking for cases, for New York cases, and I take Judge Rosenbaum's point that there's just sort of this scattershot world of New York case law that we're trying to parse, but I've been looking for New York cases that impose a duty on a clearing broker that don't involve the clearing broker engaged, not just in sort of moving beyond ministerial actions and getting involved in the nitty-gritty of the transaction, but engaged in the fraud.
Well, it doesn't have to engage. And again, we
don't know, you say it doesn't have to. And I'm asking you, like, what are cases in which a clearing broker has been found to have the duty where it wasn't engaged in the fraud? Or participating in the fraud.
McDaniel is the one.
So McDaniel, I thought you said something at the very outset just in describing McDaniel. You undoubtedly understand it better than I do, or know it better than I do, but I thought you said something about the McDaniel court concluded that the clearing broker was engaged in the fraud, or was involved.
It was. But McDaniel did. That's why this is so important. The McDaniel case holding is both with regard to fraud and with regard to breach of contract. Right? So it's not just the fraud. And because there was an agreement, one of the key factors in this case, which the MDL court totally ignored, is that there is this three-party agreement. In most of the cases that was cited by my friend, and most of the cases that's cited by the MDL court, what the MDL court and what they're looking at are cases where there is a relationship between the introductory broker and the clearinghouse, but no written agreement and no contract with regard to the customer. Here, every single customer has an agreement, and that agreement makes them customers both of the introducing broker and also customers of the clearing broker. And that's precisely the situation in McDaniel. And McDaniel says, because you have a written agreement between the customer and the clearing broker itself, you can have clearing broker liability. And not only can you have clearing broker liability, you can have clearing broker liability for restricting the purchase of stock, which is precisely here. I get the point of the panel. There is not a great deal of New York law on this point, but the principles are clear. At bottom, the conduct of Apex here was outrageous. And as we have made very, very clear, there are no other cases like this. Never did an introducing broker introduce or a clearing broker that controlled over 100 captive introducing broker dealers mandate that any customer for hours could only sell stock and not purchase the stock. And we know from the information that was turned over to the New Jersey Bureau of Securities that Apex did this purposefully for the purpose of depressing the price of the stock. You don't have any case in front of you, because there is no other case, where a major broker-dealer took the kind of action that was taken over here, where they purposefully depressed the price of the stock. And to make it worse, they did this when they had a conversation and had discussions with the clearinghouse clearinghouse, with DTCC and with NSCC, and knew, as the MDL judge found, for hours that there was no need for a collateral monetary increase. So you have a situation where you have this behemoth clearing broker who, for no business purpose, right, one, implements a one-way market halt, which no one has ever done. No one has ever done that before. No one ever has done it since, with the exception of Robinhood, and that's a whole separate issue, which took place over a very short period of time. But no clearing broker has ever done that. No clearing broker has ever done that since. Apex never did it before. Apex never did it since. And it had a dramatic impact on the price of the stock. So if you are an investor and you own any of the three stocks that are at issue over here, you've lost money. And you've lost money for one reason and one reason alone, because Apex took action purposefully designed to depress the price of the stock. And they did it, one, without making any inquiry to determine whether or not it was necessary. And then, more importantly, they held that up for about 3 hours after they had specific information that that collateral wasn't necessary. They were on the phone with DTCC. They had the information. And for hours, they allowed the market to fester.
Counsel, in New York, if I have a non-discretionary account with my broker, is my broker required to accept my buy order?
Absolutely not.
Right.
Your broker is not, but what your broker is not permitted to do.
Well, if you answered my question, so that, let me ask my follow-up question, which is, if the relationship here, because of the three-way agreement, is between Apex and the plaintiffs here as broker-customer, and yes, it is alleged they have non-discretionary accounts, how is it not that Apex is just entitled to say, I don't feel like trading today?
Well, they can.
I want to go to Coney Island. I really want to go get a hot dog and go on the roller coaster, and I'm not accepting trades today.
They certainly have the right to say they're not accepting trades, and in fact, their agreement gives them the right not to accept trades. However, I don't believe you can end the inquiry there. I think you have to look at what the purpose was. Incidentally, it wasn't in our brief, but most financial institutions...
Why?
Because there's a duty of care. Because the duty of care...
How's there a duty? The problem is, if the duty only attaches at the time of the transaction, there's no duty to accept.
No.
The problem, counsel, seems to be, and you're over time, so I'll be as brief as I can, seems to be defining transaction. You want to define it as under the Securities Exchange Act and under the Securities Act, and the district court defined it as we all would and what New York seems to have defined it as, which is the acceptance of the buy order.
I respectfully disagree, and I disagree for the following reasons. One, the MDL court did not address the issue at all, and I concede it is an important issue. There is no finding in the record here. The judge did not address the issue. Two, the important language from the Second Circuit from Kwiatkowski is that it is ordinarily in connection with the transaction. And what we argue then is that's a question of fact. That can't be dismissed on a motion to dismiss. And certainly, it is not settled law as to what a transaction is. We noted in the Conway case, for example, that the liquidation took place days and days later after the purchase. So the Second Circuit has recognized, and also in the federal securities context, which we cited from Judge Altanaga, has recognized that the word transaction can mean a lot of different things. I don't believe it is appropriate for an MDL court to sit in the Southern District of Florida and make New York law with regard to issues such as transaction when the New York courts have given a more liberal interpretation to that. And if you look at the context, right, sure, they could say we're going fishing.
Well, one way or the other, we're going to have to make New York law. I mean, you yourself have conceded there's nothing like this out there. So we need to figure out what we think the New York courts would do.
Well, I respectfully would also suggest that you have the alternative, which is to certify a number of these questions, which I think are important questions to New York courts to interpret New York law. And I don't think it was appropriate, if I might say so, for an MDL court who is looking at this issue for the first time, where there's unsettled law, and I know I'm over my time, but unsettled law with regard to a lot of these different issues, including the economic loss doctrine, and to make New York law or to interpret New York law in a way that is inconsistent with the way New York courts have interpreted it. Okay. And I think under the circumstances here, these are such important issues that before you strip investors of important protections that they have under New York law, that you please give that further consideration, and I ask that you reverse the lower court. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Saferstein. All right, we'll hear next from Mr. Gidley.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mark Gidley for Appellee Defendant Apex. With me at council table is Celia McLaughlin and Jack Pace. The plaintiffs challenge 120 years of established New York brokerage law. And let me just say, when you look at these cases, you have to parse them into sort of, I think, two buckets. One is general broker-dealer law, which is established and settled in New York State. And then second, the brokerage law that's grown up over the last 60, 80 years for clearing brokers. And I'll try to be clear on that as I go along.
Can I ask you a question? Under the way that the district court decided this case, and under what I understand your interpretation of the laws to be, could your client, let's just say every single day, pick a particular stock that it decided that it was in its best interest to stop trades on and just stop trades? And it could just do whatever it wanted to do every single day on that.
Let me start with the contract, and then we'll start with then we'll go to the practical answer. The contract. The contract, which is three-way. The, you know, retail customers see the contract.
I understand it could under the contract.
The contract clearly gives us that,
yes,
right, both in paragraph 3, and I think we underplayed paragraph 4. We can refuse any trade.
Right. But so, I guess what I'm asking you is, beyond the contract, what if every single broker-dealer decided that it was just going to figure out what trades were in its best interest on any given day and only accept those trades and not do any other trades? I mean, wouldn't that be a problem? And I mean, for larger part of the market?
Sorry, Judge Rowe.
That's all right.
First of all, we only make money when there's trading. So the times when we stopped here, as here on this day, was when there was a huge spike in prices. Robinhood cut off trading for 12 or 13 stocks. We cut off 3. So it's very rare. It happened one day. And we don't make money.
Right, but theoretically, I mean, I know you all thought it was a short squeeze situation. It looked like it at the time. But I guess since that time, it's been determined that it wasn't actually. But, I mean, you know, you could find that there was a short squeeze situation on any given day, I guess, and decide that you weren't going to, that it was in your best interest, you didn't want to have to come up with a collateral, whatever.
Let me start with this case, and then let me go to the more general sort of hypothetical you're suggesting. In this case, paragraph 119 says it was reasonable that Apex reasonably believed they had a collateral issue. That admission in paragraph 119, I think, contextualizes things.
Except it did, that's what it says, except that it later says that they found that they didn't and continued to keep the bar in place, doesn't it?
Well, the complaint also admits that it was still elevated because what was going on in the market was a huge gamma squeeze. So even though it was less than they thought at 9:30 in the morning where trading opened, it was still elevated according to paragraph 79, and this is all at docket 483. On what are the restraints generally, let me start with what the regulators say. The regulators say we want you, as a matter of risk management, this is in the red brief at page 25, we want you in the contracts to have the safety valve of being able to say no, that we're not going to accept trades for this stock at this moment. So that's the SEC. The SEC has issued two reports, January 30th and the October 21 report. Both of them quote the language that brokers reserve the right to refuse trades, and they do that as a matter of risk management. The complaint says we're doing it for self-preservation. The reply brief says that the bad motive here is we were trying to protect ourselves. That's exactly what the regulators are talking about. And the admission found in note 4 is astonishing in the reply brief. With due respect for my friends, they simply say, yes, it's completely established in New York law, and we heard it earlier in the earlier stand on the floor, that Apex can say no. Now, we've only said no one day in our existence to three stocks for 210 minutes. Why is that? And this is a long-winded way of getting back to you, Judge Rosenbaum. We only make money when there's full trading in the thousands of stocks. And there are other clearing brokers. And some clearing brokers did keep trading. So we're hurt. And our introducing brokers are hurt. They're not making money. They only make money through commissions. So there is a huge incentive to keep those 100 customers happy. They were extremely unhappy if you take a look at paragraph 71 through 79 of the complaint. That's part of the record here. And they made it clear to my client that you had a black eye day.
So the quick answer, the short answer to my question is, it would never happen that everybody would just decide that every single broker-dealer would just decide that they were going to halt trading for their own benefit because it wouldn't be to their benefit in most situations.
You would be driven out of the market, right? The free market controls that. I think at some point, and we had no sanctioning here by the SEC or by FINRA of Apex, but at some point just that market restriction that the marketplace wants to trade, and if you woke up every day and you were like, we don't like Microsoft today, you know, how could you possibly stay in business? The retail customers would go bananas. So that's why that's never happened in the history of Apex. And what
well,
I think
is... not just that the retail customers would go bananas, but you wouldn't have any trades, and so you wouldn't make any money either.
Well, actually, retail customers would go to another introducing broker, and we have
right,
that.
But what I'm saying is you wouldn't... I mean, if the way that you're making money depends on having trades... You wouldn't have trades, you wouldn't make money. Am I missing something here?
You're exactly right, okay. Especially with a popular stock like Microsoft, but for any stock. You have to be a reliable clearing broker, right? We're dealing with a world of T+2 clearing, right, where we're under tremendous risk once we accept the trade, and for the 2 days, we carry the risk in the market of the price going up and down, and the buyer backing out and not showing up with the money, and we're stuck holding the bag. That's the job. That's the role we play. We're the bridge between the introducing broker.
Can I ask you a more fundamental question? And this goes to something that my colleagues have been poking around at. There seems to be some tension between what the New York state courts have said and what some of our federal brethren have said in the Southern District of New York and on the Second Circuit. Am I reading that right? Or can this all be read together neatly and tightly, and the federal courts have not taken it upon themselves to add exceptions and to extend duties and to do things that the New York state courts have not themselves done?
Well, let me just say, first of all, there aren't that many state cases. We think Bush is fundamental, but we also have the Schwartz case, and there's one other. Let me just...
Cali?
Yeah, and sorry, Your Honor, it's... the other New York Greenfield is the one I'm searching for. Those cases are clear. You know, to me, we're eerie, Hanna versus Plumer. Why would we even look at the New York cases? We sort of look at the New York cases, and I'm a New York lawyer, just because they're convenient, they're well-written, smart
lawyers.
You're
talking about the federal cases.
Yes, the SDNY and the Second Circuit. I think to kind of cut through some of the McDaniel cloud, let me just address McDaniel, because I do think some of the federal courts have muddied the water. I'm looking at McDaniel, Your Honor, at 196 F sub second at 352, and it says, quote, on the other hand, if you'll indulge me, where a clearing firm moves beyond performing mere ministerial or routine clearing functions and becomes actively and directly involved in the introducing broker's actions, it may expose itself to liability with respect to the introducing broker's misdeeds, and then every case is a fraud case or some other kind of manipulation.
In other words, what that's saying there, it's really an aiding and abetting concept. In other words, if the introducing broker is engaged in misconduct and the clearinghouse aids and abets that misconduct actively beyond just the backdoor role, they're in it.
That's very well said. And in addition, if you look at the facts of that case, McDaniel, which is an arbitration award case, McDaniel involves Bear Stearns going uptown to live and sit at the introducing broker's offices for 6 weeks. There's clearly nothing here. that's like that. All we did was say, we are not doing these three meme stocks. If you look at the complaint, they act like somehow we reached into the introducing broker. But when we say we're not accepting those trades, there's nothing more that can be done except for the introducing broker to tell its customers immediately, right, this is during the trading day, don't accept those trades. You're going to be on the hook for them.
Is the difference, I mean, you pointed out the fraud, misdeed part of it, and I think that's what the district court hung its, the district court in our case hung its right. hat on. But it seems to be something more fundamental that in those cases, trades were in fact accepted, or there was part of a larger trading, or there weren't non-discretionary accounts. In the context of, tell me if I'm wrong on this, in New York state law, not the federal district courts, in New York state law, has there ever been found a duty where the broker rejected the trade, said someone came to their window and said, I'd like to buy this stock, and the broker says, not today, folks?
No, and if I could, Your Honor, we did additional research after we got the reply brief. I want to just supply two authorities of just pure New York state law, if I may. Amaranth versus J.P. Morgan Chase. This is 71 AD 3rd 40, and the relevant passage is at 46, and that's in 2009. That's the first department, which is New York City, Manhattan. The second case I would direct the court to is Omnivest versus Elders Futures, also the first department, 157 AD 2nd 528 at 30, and that's 1990.
I would just say, counsel, in the future for that kind of thing, please file a supplemental authority letter. It's the collegial thing to do both for us and for opposing counsel.
We will. And I apologize to the court. I want to circle back to the muddle that some of the case law has. My colleague read a quote that said, you have a duty when you accept a trade. We don't challenge that. You know, they point to paragraph one of the customer agreement and say it incorporates FINRA and SEC. That's for transactions. If we accept the trade, we're on the hook. We've got to, like, execute that trade faithfully, reasonably. You know, we can't, you know, give you, you know, NVIDIA and you were looking for Microsoft. We have to fulfill that in a reasonable way. We're on the hook. But the only safety valve is we can say no. And we can say no under Bush. Bush cites those two older cases, the New York Court of Appeals case, La Marchant, and the Supreme Court case in Gallagher. And I think the behavior here perfectly matches Gallagher. Gallagher is the interesting case where the order comes in by telegraphy and the response by the broker, it was an introducing broker, goes out by U.S. mail. And the court said, wait a minute, and this is Supreme Court before Erie, so it's federal common law, but it's incorporated into New York state law through those cases. The ruling is you've got to be prompt in telling people. And we were absolutely prompt in telling the introducing brokers what we were doing. There's no question, though, that those intermediate courts in this court, the 11th Circuit, that those give us the guide to New York law, right? You have the Fox case versus Ritz-Carlton is one of those many examples where this court has said, I'm going to look and see what the substantive rule of decision should be under Erie. And it's clearly supplied by New York state cases. The federal cases, I think, actually are consistent with this. The two-part test we were talking about earlier with McDaniel, Your Honor, we've talked a little bit about the second prong, and that's where the district court, the MDL court, went. The first prong, I think, I have a little bit of a quibble with the MDL court. The first prong really comes down to, are you behaving like a clearing broker? And frankly, I think sticking to paragraph 3 and paragraph 4 of the customer agreement, when we say no, and the SEC has said you need to have that as a risk management safety valve, that saying no was part of being a clearing broker.
Aren't the allegations, though, that your client told the introducing brokers they were not to accept any more trades with regard to any more buy orders with regard to these stocks?
Right, and that's where I'm saying they then try to go to the cases where the Bear Stearns, there's like three Bear Stearns cases involving this character, Barron, and there's an SEC enforcement action that gets into all of the 6 weeks that Bear Stearns stayed there. But the key point is if you go to the complaint and you read what the complaint alleges, and this is the fourth complaint, right? They had 20,000 documents because we had all kinds of investigations. The complaint says in paragraph 71 on Webull, and I'm over my time, so I'll be quick. It says on Webull.
Not actually. You've still got a minute 30 left.
Oh, okay. I'm on yellow. So paragraph 71 says, we were told by Apex we need to stop, you know, accepting buy orders for these meme stocks. And I'm like, that's pretty articulate, right? When your clearing broker says your trades are not going to go through T plus two settlement through the NSCC and the DTC, you're out of business for trying to help customers buy those three stocks. And of course, that makes the introducing brokers furious. But it's not being a clearing broker. It's not becoming an introducing broker, giving advice, saying NVIDIA is a good stock. That's what introducing brokers do. We disclaim all of that in paragraph six. We don't care what stock you hold. We don't care whether the stock goes up or down. Why is that? Because some of our introducing brokers are saying buy Microsoft. At the same time, some of them are saying sell Microsoft. So we can't have a view on Microsoft or any of these stocks. What happened here was we thought that there was a real problem, a billion-dollar problem, according to the record.
I will say, I want to go back to that, because if you look at paragraph 71, and I think that's the right area in the amended complaint, again, the allegation is that your client informed the introducing broker that they needed to shut off the ability to do something. That's different than just we are either going to clear your trade or not clear your trade consistent with guidelines. This is you need to shut off this function so that there can be no more buy orders there. That seems to go out of the back door role and more into the front door.
Well, first of all, I have the right to say no under paragraph 3 and 4.
We're not talking about that, though.
Right. So to implement that during the trading day, you should be unambiguous that if you accept these trades, they're not going to be cleared through us. And there's no evidence in the record that any of the introducing brokers had other clearing arrangements. So it's tantamount, and it's the courteous thing to do to say, don't accept these three stocks while we're in this status. So we don't think there's any other way to behave. And it's not the same thing as coming down off your pedestal, no longer being a clearing broker and becoming an introducing broker and talking about why this stock is a good stock or whatever.
Just so I understand, to sort of like, in my mind, sort of bring this full circle, you're still, I think, in your discussion here on your quibble with the first part of the district court, the MDL court's analysis. You would say, even if everything you just said for the last 5 minutes is wrong, you would still say that unless you're actively engaged in the misconduct,
right,
you're not on the hook. You don't have the duty.
Clearly, the MDL court got it correct on the second prong. On the first prong, I reread that paragraph several times. I get guidance, Your Honor, from the Levitt opinion, and I'm looking at page 465, 710 F3rd at 465. And the way the Levitt court, this is in 2013, so McDaniel's 2002, it goes through and synthesizes pretty well the law. And it says there, applying these principles, district court and this circuit have distinguished two categories of cases. First, in cases where a clearing broker was simply providing normal clearing services, district courts have declined to impose liability on the clearing broker for the transgressions of the introducing broker. And my point is, saying no is fundamentally part of being a clearing broker. And we clearly win on the second prong, but that's our quibble.
Gotcha. All right, thank you very much. Mr. Saferstein, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you. I want to point out that in addition to the cases that I cited before, I think the Global Enterprise Group Holdings case is important as well, because there the Southern District of New York Court held that fiduciary duties may exist where a clearing broker asserts control over the introducing broker's business or it becomes actively and directly involved in an introductory broker's actions. That is clearly what happened here. And you have a finding of fact by the MDL court that this activity that was done was beyond simply the ministerial functions, that they took over control over the actions of the introductory broker. So then the question becomes, are there any consequences for this? Does the court really believe that there are no limits as to what a financial institution such as a clearing broker can do to its customers?
Give us the parade of horribles.
Well, Judge Rosenbaum, going back to the question that you presented to my friend, we're talking about three meme stocks. Let's say Apex decided tomorrow that they're shutting down for hours the ability of people to purchase Apple. Is that okay?
But
or Tesla?
Why would they do that? Well, based on the representations from Mr. Gidley, well, they lose money when they don't sell.
Well, I would turn the question right back to him, and the question is, If they knew that there was no collateral increase at 12 o'clock, it was based upon his representation in his brief to the court, and the MDL court found that as of noon, there was no reason to have this halt. And they didn't do anything, and they didn't lift it until 2:55.
But I'm still... I'm asking you though, what is the incentive? There may well be one. What is the incentive? But I don't know what it is.
Well, assuming that you don't know what it is, which you don't, is the court going to say that that's okay? And if the court says it's okay, then what you are saying is that any broker-dealer or any clearing broker-dealer at any time, which has a standard agreement, they all have standard agreements that say they don't have to accept stock.
It's more than that. I don't know what it is. It's that there's no indication that there was something nefarious or fraudulent or underhanded going on. And you haven't explained to me, and this is just a practical, I'm not talking about the law here. I'm trying to figure out the big picture. So from a practical standpoint, what is the incentive for broker-dealers to act in this way if we don't agree with your position?
I don't think broker-dealers, as I think, this is a horrible situation. I don't think broker-dealers ever have the justification to do this or that it's ever okay, but which is why they're...
I'm not asking about justification. I'm asking about incentive.
I don't believe that they had a proper incentive. If they knew that the collateral wasn't going to be increased, first of all, they should have asked in the first place. Once they find out by noon that there isn't going to be a collateral increase, what is the business reason for keeping such a draconian act in place? They're introducing brokers.
You're saying it doesn't benefit them in any way.
There's no record evidence that it does. The inference, and we are on a motion to dismiss, the inference is that if they have the specific information, which the district court found at noon, that there isn't a business reason to have this draconian one-way market suspension, and they keep the market suspension till 2:55, so it's 3 hours, then there's nothing for you to consider that there was any rational or reasonable reason for them to do it. The only thing that you do know for a fact is that the investors lost money. And the question that I would put to this court as well as to the lower, to the MDL court, is, are there no consequences? Can a broker dealer, can a clearing broker dealer shut down the system purposefully to drive down the price of the stock and say, we have no liability? The FINRA rules make it very clear that implicit in all customer agreements, there is a duty of care. What the district court did is throw that out. I am begging you to please do not throw out years and years of regulations and years of jurisprudence protecting investors to allow broker-dealers or clearing broker-dealers to act in a way that purposefully harms investors and has no demonstrable benefit to clearing broker-dealers.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Safferstein. Thank you both. We'll be in recess.